Yes, greetings from Carolina. No laughter there. But I learned that people here in South Carolina, some folks think that the University of South Carolina is the first state university, but we don't believe that's true. But this is a subject for another debate. I'm going to be, does this work? Do you know?
Plus five. Right.
Does not.
That's all right. I'll just pull this out and I'll go back and forth.
That's fine. If I do my job, I'm going to speak for about 25 minutes, and then I wanted to leave plenty of time for us to be in dialogue together. So please, if you have a question, think about it, jot it down, give yourself a note on your phone or something to remember it. There's a lot of different directions we could take the conversation, and so I want to make sure I'm responsive to what you're interested in. But as Dr. Tolleson said, I practice palliative medicine at Duke University, and specifically palliative medicine in Durham, North Carolina. And not long ago, I was asked to see a patient in the emergency room of one of our hospitals. And the patient, who I will call Mr. Roberts, had advanced dementia. He had not spoken in 3 years. And he was brought to the hospital by his brother and his niece, who for several years had cared for the patient at home. And the ER docs did their initial evaluation. And that evaluation made clear that Mr. Roberts had a large pneumonia, and he was beginning to suffer septic shock and respiratory failure. And after I spoke with them briefly, Mr. Roberts' family members agreed with my proposal that we give him antibiotics, oxygen, and other supportive therapy, but that we forego putting him on a respirator, putting him on a breathing machine. And then we forego that even if he came to the point where he was not able to breathe on his own. And I then asked his brother and niece if they had ever considered hospice care for Mr. Roberts. After all, he had very advanced dementia. He clearly would qualify for hospice care. And both of them shook their heads and said adamantly, we're definitely not interested in hospice. Why? I asked. They responded as I have heard a number of others respond in Durham, North Carolina, as well as on the south side of Chicago, where I practiced hospice medicine for several years before moving to North Carolina. They said, hospice too often foregoes any effort to provide medical care for patients and instead focuses only on giving potent drugs like morphine and sedatives and thereby hastening patients' death. Now, I begin with this story because it points to the question, what does it mean for physicians, as physicians, to maintain solidarity with those who are suffering and diminished by their illness? And what does that have to do with death with dignity? Now, death with dignity is the term used in a number of laws. All of them in the United States have been modeled after the law initially passed in Oregon. And again, a number of states have adopted these. Canada, Belgium, the Netherlands, and as of this week, New Zealand are countries where death with dignity has been legalized. And the term refers to physicians helping patients to die, either by giving them a prescription for a concoction of drugs that can be used as medications, but in this case are used to cause the patient's death, or by, and we call that physician-assisted suicide, or by directly killing the patient through a lethal injection, intravenous injection, which is the practice more, for example, in Canada. You guys may know Canada legalized euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide a couple of years ago, and virtually all the deaths are through euthanasia, lethal injections. The language used to refer to these practices is contested along the same lines that the practices themselves are contested. Advocates for these practices call them death with dignity. which sounds certainly like a good thing. We have terms like compassion and choices, which is the primary political organization in the U.S. that has been advocating for these laws, and physician aid in dying. Critics, and as you'll see, I am one of those critics, use the terms physician-assisted suicide, voluntary euthanasia, which is a more precise term than physician aid in dying, but interestingly, the etymology of euthanasia is just a good death. That being said, euthanasia is pretty internationally recognized as giving a patient some kind of intervention to directly cause their death, or even physician killing. I'm going to use the term generally physician-assisted death to be as descriptive as I know how. These are practices in which the physician aims at getting the patient dead and helps to bring that about. With respect to these practices, then, consider with me, if you would, which of the following physicians should care most about? Which of these is most important for physicians? One, maintaining the trust of those who, like Mr. Roberts and his family, already experienced the debility, dependence, and suffering that advanced illness brings. Or two, empowering those who, like the young woman Brittany Maynard, seek through assisted suicide or euthanasia to avoid such debility, dependence, and suffering. Now, you guys are young, most of you, so you may not remember Brittany Maynard, but she was diagnosed with brain cancer in January of 2014 and became a prominent public advocate for the legalization of physician-assisted suicide. She moved from California to Oregon, and per a plan that she had specified in advance, she died on November 1st of that year after ingesting a lethal cocktail of drugs. And Brittany Maynard's story illustrates a pattern. Those who seek physician-assisted death are rarely driven by the direct experience of refractory pain or other symptoms. If you listen to those advocating for assisted death, you'll hear about not leaving people with unbearable suffering. And the reality is that if you look at the data on people who have availed themselves of assisted death, they are the incidence of people saying they have uncontrolled symptoms is very small. Rather, as Brittany Maynard herself said, she chose to end her life on her own terms in order to avoid the prospect of further debility and decline, in which she might suffer personality changes and verbal, cognitive, and motor loss of virtually any kind. I should say you can read her manifesto. It's still available on CNN.com if you search for it. It kind of went viral. Ms. Maynard's desire to avoid debility and dependence reflects the pattern found in official reports from Oregon and Washington State, where 9 out of 10 patients requesting assisted suicide have reported being concerned about losing autonomy and being less able to engage in activities making life enjoyable. So the problem to which physician-assisted death poses a solution, it's not uncontrolled pain, it's not grievous and irremediable suffering, which was the language used in the decision by the Supreme Court of Canada to say that Canadians have a constitutional right to end their lives in this way. In Oregon, as I said, only 1 in 4 patients has reported even being concerned about inadequate pain control. And at no time in history have physicians and patients had greater access to effective tools for treating pain and other distressing symptoms. Tools which we can deploy aggressively under ethical norms that have guided medicine for ages. The problem to which assisted suicide or euthanasia poses a solution is the problem of loss of control, loss of one's capacity to determine one's future. In an article a few years ago published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Timothy Quill, who's sort of the foremost physician advocate for aid in dying or physician-assisted death in the United States, he and colleagues wrote, quote, "Patients with serious illness wish to have control over their own bodies, their own lives, and concern about future physical and psychosocial distress." And Brittany Maynard put the point bluntly in her online manifesto, writing, "I want to die on my own terms." She then added, "My question is, who has the right to tell me that I don't deserve this choice?" Now that question is a powerful question in our day. The former Hemlock Society is now called Compassion and Choices. The California law legalizing assisted suicide was called the End of Life Options Act. When Governor Jerry Brown signed it, he said he did not know if he would avail himself, if he himself would avail himself of assisted suicide, but, quote, "I wouldn't deny that right to others." So in our world, choice looms large. But what kind of choice is it, is Ms. Maynard and others like her being denied if physicians refuse to participate in assisted death? Think about this with me. Ms. Maynard already had the right to refuse any life-sustaining technologies, any medical treatment whatsoever. She had the right to palliation of her symptoms, and palliation that was effective palliation, even if death were hastened as a side effect of the palliation that she might need. She had the liberty to cause her death by numerous methods which do not involve physicians and which are equally, if not more, efficient and effective than ingesting an overdose, a slurry of pharmaceuticals. And I'm not making light here of the very real and tragic problem of suicide. On the contrary, but the point is a simple one. If one wants to set out to cause one's own death, there are many different ways to do that that do not involve physicians. So why is it so essential that she and others have physicians in particular cooperate in helping them to kill themselves? That physicians are being asked to cooperate suggests that the right to choose is, as the late Robert Burt noted, radically incomplete as a justification for physician-assisted suicide. The confident assertion of the self-determination right, he continues, leaves unacknowledged and unanswered a crucial background question: who can be trusted to care for me when I'm too vulnerable and fearful to care for myself? Now that is not a rhetorical question for many of my patients. I jumped ahead one slide, I think. Yeah, I'll just leave that up. That's not a rhetorical question for many of my patients. Indeed, they, like too many others, have come to the conclusion that some physicians who wield the tools of palliative medicine are not to be trusted. Because such physicians have so prioritized relieving suffering that they fail to do what patients count on physicians to do, namely, to use reasonable means to preserve the health and life of the patient. So, insofar as that's true, how much less would Mr. Roberts' family, the patient I told you about, would that family entrust him to a physician or a group of physicians that is in the habit of practicing physician-assisted death? It seems to me hard to imagine that their worries will be assuaged by hearing that the physicians do so only for patients who choose. "We're only going to kill you if you choose that." So herein lies the rub, it seems to me. Physicians cannot practice causing the death of their patients without undermining the trust on which the practice of medicine depends. And this is not a new insight. This is not an original idea at all. Physicians who care for patients with advanced illness have long known that both they and their patients will at times be tempted to do away with the suffering by doing away with the one who suffers. To mitigate against that temptation, physicians have for more than two millennia, those who have inherited the Hippocratic tradition and developed that, have for more than two millennia sworn in the Hippocratic oath, I will never give a deadly drug to anybody who asks for it, nor will I make a suggestion to this effect. The American Medical Association has maintained since its founding that physician-assisted suicide is fundamentally inconsistent with the physician's professional role. That was in the 19th and 20th century, there's an unbroken, in terms of public medical associations in the West, there's unbroken consistency about affirming that norm from the time of Hippocrates until the 1960s when it started to break up a little bit. And really only in the last 20 years have larger organizations started to accept this practice. So insofar as physicians enjoy the trust of patients made vulnerable by illness, it's because since Hippocrates, at least, they have maintained solidarity with those who are sick and disabled, seeking only to heal and refusing to use their skills and powers to do harm. That's why physicians have refused to participate in capital punishment. They refuse to be active combatants in war. And they refuse to help patients commit suicide. Importantly, this boundary against intentionally causing the patient's death not only gives patients a reason to trust physicians, but, and I experienced this as a practitioner myself, it gives physicians like me the freedom we need to do our work. So, for example, I was able to tell Mr. Roberts' family members who were concerned about what I was going to do in relieving his breathlessness, I was able to tell them that as a physician, I'm committed to never intentionally hastening, much less directly causing, a patient's death. Never. This boundary creates a space in which I and other physicians can act decisively to palliate distressing symptoms. So in Mr. Roberts' case, to use morphine, for example, to alleviate his breathlessness. Without that boundary, if Mr. Roberts' family does not believe that that boundary is real for me, then they have good reason to worry that the morphine that I'm giving Mr. Roberts that does lead to sedation as a side effect is not dosed in proportion to the pain or breathlessness, but in an effort to kind of hurry this process along. You know, this guy who's just so old and so demented and, you know, has such low quality of life, let's ease this along. Now I'll close by returning to the question of solidarity I posed at the outset. Which should be most important to physicians? Maintaining the trust of those who, like Mr. Roberts and his family, already experience the debility, dependence, and suffering that advanced illness brings? Or two, empowering those who, like Brittany Maynard, seek through assisted death to avoid such debility, dependence, and suffering? Which of those is most important to seemingly fitting for physicians? The witness of physicians and patients through the centuries and into the present has affirmed that we can't have it both ways. Now, I recently participated in a public debate of sorts with Timothy Quill, who I mentioned earlier, on this topic. And the night of our event, which was held at a facility in Durham, across town at the Durham Performing Arts Center, Reality Ministries of Durham was having its 10th annual talent show. And the performers included dozens of people with developmental disabilities who, to borrow Ms. Maynard's terms, suffer verbal, cognitive, and motor loss of virtually every kind. These performers drew an audience of roughly 1,000 persons. And as the organizers promised, they inspired, encouraged, and empowered in a way that no other show can. Because somehow this show tells people something about God's presence in our midst. That's the way they put it. Now, whether or not you're persuaded that God is present in our midst, the performers at this reality talent show displayed a truth that Brittany Maynard and so many others could not see. That is that debility and dependence do not render lives not worth living. That human dignity does not require living or dying on one's own terms. That truth is obscured by a culture that emphasizes success and productivity, youthfulness and beauty, autonomy and control. Look again, if you would, at these public images of Brittany Maynard. Right? You see beauty, youth, freedom, enjoyment, wealth, likely. It's not incidental that those who advocate for and avail themselves of assisted death are overwhelmingly white, well-off, and accustomed to being able-bodied. So according to official reports, of the more than 1,000 people who have died in Oregon by assisted suicide, one has been African-American. Statistically, one would have expected at least 20. In Washington State's most recent report, only 2% of deaths by assisted suicide were non-white. In California in 2018, of the 337 people who died by physician-assisted suicide, 3 were black, less than 1%, and 13 were Hispanic, which is less than 4%. California is 39% Hispanic. Mr. Roberts' family, like most of my patients in Chicago and Durham, was African-American. If verbal, cognitive, and motor loss renders life not worth living, you might think also that disability groups would welcome assisted suicide. But the opposite is the case. Disability groups overwhelmingly oppose assisted suicide. The prominent advocacy group, Not Dead Yet, speaks for many in arguing that, quote, it cannot be seriously maintained that legalization of assisted suicide will not lead to inappropriate pressures from family or society for people to end their lives. The group contends that assisted suicide laws ensure legal immunity for physicians, as this is how they put it, for physicians who already devalue the lives of older and disabled people and have significant economic incentives to at least agree with their suicides, if not encourage them, or worse. And in making the point that assisted death falls outside the boundaries of good medicine, it seems to me it should be enough to remind us that it's never permissible for anyone to kill the innocent, nor help the innocent kill themselves. If we think, however, that helping someone to commit suicide is justifiable if the person has a terminal illness, and if the person chooses to die, and if we think that we have lots of bureaucratic safeguards to make sure that both of these conditions hold true, that they're actually not being pressured at all, and that they really have an illness that's going to take their life very soon, then it still seems to me it should be enough to remind us that killing contradicts the very nature of the practice of medicine, the very kind of commitment that makes a practitioner of medicine a practitioner of medicine. And here I'm speaking of its orientation to the patient's health. It seems then that if anyone is to help patients to take their lives, it shouldn't be the physician. But even if these time-tested reasons against physician-assisted death have lost their grasp on our imaginations, and we might, I think, wonder, what is it that's happening to our imaginations when we can no longer see what was so clear to those who've gone before us? Is it just that we've progressed, or is it that we've become blinded in some way to something important? Even if that's the case, can we not still say that it is unjust for physicians to facilitate yet another choice for those accustomed to living life on their own terms at the cost of betraying physicians' distinctive solidarity with and thereby undermining the trust of those who live under the terms of illness and disability, which they have not chosen, but with respect to which they should be able to count on physicians' care? I'll stop there and welcome any of your questions. Yes, in the back.
I find that sometimes I go back and forth on issues like this when I'm having doubts with my faith, and then it kind of swings with the faith or lack of faith that I have. Have you gone back and forth on this issue throughout your practice, or have you ever had moments of doubt, and how have you worked with that, wrestled with that?
Thank you for that question. I have not struggle with doubt on this issue. I'm one of those folks who's still perplexed that I can see how we ended up here, but it has not. I haven't found myself wondering if it might be a good idea. That being said, I know there are many people who have, and I was recently called, in fact, last week, by a physician who has moved to Washington State, and this physician cares for people who have ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and she just wanted to talk through the issue because she was struggling with how she should think about it. And she was a kind of surprised that she was struggling because she thought she would oppose it. But then she started hearing the stories of folks saying, this is really important to me, and it's an important choice for me, et cetera, et cetera. So we're in a world in which it seems to me we have become very squeamish about the notion that any of us would decide for someone else that something is wrong. And I find that being a very powerful sense that, you know, I don't really like this practice. I don't think I can participate in it, but I could never say for someone else that it's wrong for them. And once you've made that move, then you have to ask yourself, well, if that's true, if you don't think it could be wrong for them, then why won't you at least cooperate in the practice?
I have a question. I'm just not sure of extending some of your logic, because you started talking about making a choice with the patient about denying the ventilator. Can you talk through where the dignity of the physician comes into play with ceasing to provide or refusing to provide care that you have that you think could extend the life, and how that's different from something?
It's a great question, because I'll just say as a physician taking care of people who are with advanced illness, I mean, frequently families will struggle with whether they can justifiably stop or give consent to the stopping of some life-sustaining technology. There are a couple key distinctions. One of them is that when you stop some kind of life-sustaining technology, you can see right away that you need not necessarily be aiming to cause the patient's death. And I don't mean this just in a formalistic way, but if you just think about what you're doing, let's say it's a ventilator. Why would I stop the ventilator? One reason to stop the ventilator is so that that person will die. And it seems to me if that's what you're doing, then you are ineffectively doing something ethically parallel to, it's a form of physician-assisted death. But another way to do it, and this is, in my experience, by far the more common reason to do it, certainly the only reason I would do it, is because the ventilator brings with it a whole basket of burdens that it doesn't make sense for us to accept all those burdens when the goal of the ventilator, to preserve some measure of health, to restore a patient's health in a certain way, is not really available. It's not doing what it is used to do. So it's either not effective or it's effective at too great a cost. And the reality is all of us, we face innumerable different opportunities for pursuing things that are good, including our own health and life. some of you guys had dinner this evening and did not eat kale and beets and, you know, fava beans. Instead ate a french fry. I bet somebody in here ate a french fry. And did you do that even, how could you justify that even knowing that it was not as healthy as something else? Well, probably you didn't eat the french fry to diminish your health. That was not your intention. You ate it for other reasons. There's other goods available there. And the side effects in terms of your health is not so great that it couldn't be reasonably accepted as a side effect. And with medicine in a much more serious way, if you had to use every available technology to sustain your life as long as possible, you would, we see this all the time, you end up doing what seems pursuing very goods that are very minor with respect to your own vocation and accepting all kinds of burdens that are disproportionate to those benefits. Yes?
First, I'll say I really appreciate this talk. Really fascinating and interesting. Interesting to think about. I'm not sure exactly where I fall, but I will present an argument that I've heard.
Sure.
I used to work in a dialysis clinic. You see a lot of people towards the end of life there. One argument I heard, I certainly don't know if I feel this way, but is that I think it's like 95% of healthcare spending is in the last 5% of life. And I may have butchered that.
Yeah, that's right. Something like that is a common idea, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you say to people who argue, hey, if we pursued these ideas of ending life earlier or not providing as extensive of care in later stages of life and use those dollars towards preventative or the idea of Medicare for all, things like this, right? What's your response to that kind of argument, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no,
could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, the question is about the observation that a high proportion of the total costs spent on healthcare are spent on people in the last stages of their life. The percentages are, being exact on those is not really necessary at this point. It's true. First thing to say is that, of course, part of the challenge of these studies is they're done retrospectively. You don't generally know, sometimes you do, but you don't generally know when someone gets sick that this is going to be the sickness that causes their death. And so, of course, you spend a high proportion of money on healthcare when people are sick. And you're typically sick before you die with most illnesses. You can die suddenly of a heart attack, but that's not when most people die. So, but the second thing to say is that physician-assisted death is not necessary to achieve savings, even if we are trying to achieve savings by spending less on people who are already moribund, who are going to die. You don't need physician-assisted death to do that. You can just stop doing the things that you think are not bringing about sufficient good relative to their costs, right? And there are countries that do that just as a matter of necessity because they have limited healthcare budgets, or they just culturally have decided we're not going to prioritize certain kinds of treatments, even though they might keep some people alive longer. And that seems to me often reasonable. But making the doctor the agent of the death is just unnecessary. So still, you're going back to that question of, well, if we want to stop spending so much money, what are ways of stopping to spend so much money? The last one ought to be, let's get the doctors to kill the patients, it seems to me, because of all the problems of that. The third is, or another point is that it seems to me, when we start measuring our lives in terms of we have to pay attention to cost, but when we start thinking of our lives as opportunities, our deaths as opportunities to save money, I mean, I worry about that. In Canada, someone did a study that showed that they had saved however many millions, I think it was 50 million or 100 million or something like that. It's not a huge number, you know, in the healthcare budget, but it was a little sobering that people were starting to plot out how much money was being saved by people taking themselves away. And that's part of why the disability community has been largely so opposed to assisted suicide. They said, listen, we've been hearing the murmurings of, you know, why are we spending so much money on these people who can't even talk forever? So we don't like the idea of let's get rid of the people that are expensive.
Are you for assisted suicide, even though if it's not done by a physician?
I'm not. But I would be, if I was, I would far prefer that to having physicians involved.
Sure.
I mean, I'm going to be provocative here. It's real simple technology. Anybody seen No Country for Old Men?
Yep.
Right. Remember the bolt? It's an air, you know, it's an air compressor, and the bolt used to kill large animals in a humane way, right? The bolt shoots right into the brain, pops right back out, and you do it again. Kills them instantly. No pain. You can do that with people. And all you could license funeral homes to, you know, they go to a little training, they have a little room, it's the death with dignity room. You walk in there, you sit down, and someone who's trained comes in and says you're ready, and put it on your head, and they can take you right in there and embalm you. It'd be cheaper, more efficient, it'd be clearer what we're doing. And I can't see any moral distinction in terms of like why the physician being involved somehow makes it more palatable, except that it gives the patina, the facade of this being just medicine, even though it's sort of anti-medicine. Yes.
So you had talked a little bit during your presentation about like the difference between health versus well-being, and I guess my question for you is like, what differentiates, like, or I guess, when does health become about being alive? Because it sounded like during what you were talking about, like, your health in a physician's eyes is about keeping you alive, but, like, when does health solely become the distinction of being alive, whereas your health may, in a case, be you not being alive?
Yeah.
In that situation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, and there's not a I can't give a super, satisfying answer. It seems to us that that health and life are kind of one thing ultimately. Everybody who's alive has a measure of health, and at the same time, just prolonging your life, there comes a point where that seems to be less fitting for physicians. There's a famous kind of philosopher, critic, bioethicist who was at the University of Chicago and was the chair of the President's Council on Bioethics several years ago named Leon Cass, who wrote a famous essay about health. Called The End of Medicine and the Pursuit of Health. And in it he said, you know, the end of medicine is to preserve and restore health. It's not just to keep someone alive. He says, uses this analogy, he said the goal is to keep the strings in tune, not to bend them out of shape trying to make them last forever.
So then I guess my question is, how does prolonging someone's life, if per se, they're going to have a terminal illness and know that they're going to die a slow, painful death, how is that not helping their health by providing them with this assistance?
Well, you have to ask yourself, first of all, that's a fair question. What is, when you say, like, how does the assisted suicide or the euthanasia, how does that help their health?
It really depends on their definition of health.
Yes, but I mean, under what definition of health could we understand it to be helping?
I would say, like, living a life defined by your own standards as worth living for. And for someone it may depend on certain standards. Like, I have people in my life who are living with terminal illnesses, and they're completely content just living the way that they are, but for someone else, that may not be the situation. So what determines your right as a physician to say that this is not your definition of health?
Well, that's just it. I mean, I think this is a good example of those two different ways of understanding what medicine is for. If medicine is for pursuing a patient's vision of what is best for them, and they could use the term health to describe that, or they could use the term well-being, which is a common way people describe it, then I think you're right. Then if that's it, and if nothing is in itself either good or bad, it's just wanted or not wanted, and what we have an obligation to do is to help people pursue what they want, then assisted suicide is, your opposition to assisted suicide would have to be kind of a prudential one, and it might be, well, that's all well and good, but if my helping you have the health, what you call health, which is death, if that undermines my ability to take care of Mr. Roberts and family members like him, and if you can get the same help by just asking a friend to end your life, then I might have a prudential reason to say, you know, figure out someone else who's not going to have the side effect of making my profession harder to do. But I think you see here how important it is whether we think that health is an actual bodily good that you can't just decide, no one can just decide, well, that's health for me or that's not health for me. In fact, that there's a reality there. And I think health is that sort of thing. It's the sort of thing we share with other animals. Human health is different than the health of a squirrel, for example, but it's not totally different. And if you see a squirrel that never chatters, never beats its tail, can't climb a tree, can't bury a nut, can't chase another squirrel, you know, if someone tells you, well, in my view, that squirrel is healthy, you know, I think most of us would say, well, I think you're just mistaken. And humans are different because humans can say themselves, that's my, you know, I don't want to climb trees, I don't want to bury nuts. This is my vision, but it seems to me we're departing from health toward satisfying a vision of what we desire, all things considered.
Yeah, I think